look at Pollen's case against industrial food in section 2 of defense of food. That's the reading you had for quiz. And then I wanted to give you some notes, and maybe you didn't get to the Nestle reading so much, but you know, I want to give you some notes on that that kind of helps deepen our story about U.S. food, government food policy and history of U.S. experience with food. And so I'll try to tie those things together in the last few minutes of the class. Feel free to interrupt with questions. Okay, so why does Pollen start with this study of Aborigines, right? Well, the main reason is because it was the study, you can start your notes here, the Aborigines study was the first study that got us thinking about metabolic disease. And metabolic disease, I had somebody look up this in the last class, so I didn't have it tip of my tongue. For your notes, metabolic syndrome, I'm sorry, it's not a disease, it's a syndrome. That means we don't really understand it as a disease. We don't know its causation completely, but it's a syndrome defined by high blood pressure, diminished insulin response, because of glycemic response, and midsection weight, belly fat. And when you have these three factors, it predicts really negative health outcomes. Now, we don't know. So the point for your notes is it's a holistic disease of the diet. And remember, he just finished trashing the idea of thinking about diets in terms of nutrients, right? That's nutritionism. Remember that? That's the ideology of nutritionism. So now he's shifting to, like, well, so how do we understand the diseases of the Western diet? Well, they're holistic diseases that come in the form of syndromes. And the way we know that they're holistic, in part, is research like... it comes up a little later. Sorry about that. I'll just flip to it since I mentioned it. Research like this guy's, Jacobs and Stephan study, I think, I don't know if they're guys or women, where you could have an epidemiological study and you could track people who are getting the same nutrients, but they're not getting the same foods. And so the point for your notes is that studies like this suggests that that the diseases of the diet are holistic diseases, just because, and that the diet, it has a holistic effect. Yeah. It's gonna get too cold. You know, it does. Fast. Oh no. Like in a minute, maybe. Okay. So that was a big moment in the 80s when that. But since then, we've studied metabolic syndrome a lot. And really, the lesson in the first part here, just for your notes, is that it was the people who started noticing food cultures that didn't have our diseases. And that was in the early 20th century. People, you know, intellectuals and travelers, early traveling anthropologists, that's where Weston Price comes into the picture, an amateur scientist in some ways, but he's just looking at a lot of people's teeth and he's understanding food diseases holistically as they are reflected in teeth health, tooth health. Now remember, when he's noticing vitamin differences, these vitamins were only discovered within the 40 years of the 20th century. So it's kind of important for your notes that these are people who are noticing differences in diets even when we've just discovered vitamins. So it's a pretty interesting moment. Okay. But the main action in, we're going to talk about synthetic nitrogen fertilizers a lot when we study soil in a few weeks, so I won't bother saying much about that, but Albert Howard was another early intellectual who noticed that, who hypothesized, let's put it this way in your notes, hypothesized that it depleted soils can't provide nutrients for food. I mean, it's that simple. So he suspected, he didn't have the proof, but he suspected that synthetic nitrogen fertilizers were part of the degradation of the soil. It's a great story, synthetic nitrogen. It's where we figured out in World War II, it was a German scientist, like a bomb maker, figured out how to get nitrogen out of the air. You know, the air is mostly, it's what, 78% nitrogen or something? 20-some percent oxygen. So, you know, this was hailed as a tremendous victory. And it's part of what's behind the Green Revolution is that you can suddenly produce as much nitrogen fertilizer as you want because you've got an industrial process for getting it out of the air. Anyway, we'll get to that later. So this is where the main action is, and this is where I'd like you guys to chime in a bit more now in trying to detail his case, because this is the case against industrial food. He makes it in 5 points, right? And the general idea is that we need to get back to a more ecological way of thinking about food. And again, that invokes the kind of holism that we've been talking about. Okay, so let's kind of take it one step at a time here. So let's get us back to Carl's Jr. too. So first, whole foods to refine. Could you just go to page 107 in the book? Or could you guys take a minute and try to recuperate in your own words what changes did the roller mill bring in? Let's just take a minute, take a couple minutes and just kind of revise those pages. Being able to say stuff in your own words is huge for understanding. I'm looking at like 108. There's a lot of detail here. Okay, so what do you learn here about roller mills? How do they affect the wheat product? You want to take us into this?
Is it more sustainability, longer shelf life?
Well, shelf life. I mean, sustainability would be more of like, you know, an ecological term.
Yeah, sorry.
That's fine.
Wrong choice.
Yeah, So start your notes there. Roller mills allowed us to produce flour nationally that would keep for weeks and months.
Also removes all nutrition.
It's what?
Removes almost all the nutrition.
Yeah, let's get into that. So the trade-off is, why was there a trade-off between, you know, let's get into what the roller mill does. What does it take out?
The germ and everything.
Fiber, germ, and what else?
Vitamin B,
folic acid, right? Is that vitamin B? Folic acid? No, those are separate. So we get it. So by separating out the germ and chaff and we can finally get real white flour. With stone milling, it was a labor-intensive process. You never quite got white flour. It was always a little yellowish. Some of the oils were still in there, right? What other details from your review here?
It like changed the culture away from having flour mills that had to be like in every town.
That's a really huge cultural change. We have a flour mill, you know, where there's a fancy restaurant, Clinker Daggers. You know, that would be an example of a water-powered flour mill every town would have. And now you've got, you know, just a couple of really big industrial mills. Yeah, what else? Good, that's a big cultural detail. Because once there's no local flour mill, that means if you're a farmer and you're growing specialty grains, you can't really mill them industrially. Now you could probably buy a piece of equipment to do that. The key thing is that the roller milling process took the oils out of the flour that would have made it go rancid. So the eye opener for me in studying flour was that flour is a fresh product, and I didn't grow up thinking that. I don't know about you guys. I grew up seeing this big white paper bag in the pantry that would just always stay there, it seemed like, you know, and it was like, okay, it's stable, and it doesn't smell bad. But when you start thinking about flour as a fresh product, it starts to open up not just the nutritional angle, but the gastronomic, the satisfaction angle. So a taste test you could do, if you haven't done it, I mean, you've eaten these products separately, is to go buy an industrial loaf of bread, like an industrial wheat bread, and give them the benefit of the doubt, because it's wheat, right? It's not really whole wheat. It's highly milled wheat, so it's actually going to deteriorate, sort of like white flour. But anyway, buy an industrial loaf of bread like that. Give yourself a high-quality industrial loaf like Dave's Killer Bread, which is loaded with great ingredients. And then go downtown and buy
a baguette or loaf from Common Crumb, right? It's an artisan bakery. We have several in town. And I need to document this, and you guys could do this as an item of food research, but I'm pretty sure Common Crumb is buying freshly milled flour. I mean, if you taste them next to each other, that would be interesting to find out. But my hunch is that they're buying flour that's been milled, I'm going to say, within 2 to 3 weeks of their using it. I've read about artisan bakers. That's what artisan bread is going to be different. And when you taste it side by side, take a bite of one, chew it, notice what's happening to the bread even before you swallow it. In the case of the industrial wheat bread, it's going to deteriorate. It's going to break down immediately in your mouth. But in the case of the artisan bread, it's just going to have a very different characteristic. And these are all whole wheat breads. It reminds me of a story. Have you gone to a bread factory? Did you ever do that when you were like, yeah, did you? Okay, like in school? Was it a school trip?
Well, I've been to like the Bodie factory in San Francisco.
Oh, cool. It was like there were public tours. Yeah. So there was a, I hadn't thought about this story for a while, but there was a, somebody in the first class talked about us finding a nail in a biscuit or a piece of bread or something. So this was a school trip, and I went along because I was the kind of dad who always went to the school trip. I really enjoyed that. And so we go into this Snyder factory, and we'll read more about industrial bread versus real bread. But the guy was really proud of this feature because, you can imagine it's like bread loaves on conveyor belts everywhere, just picture that kind of factory atmosphere. And he said, well, kids, I got a really cool safety thing to show you. This feature of the conveyor belt will detect metal in the bread. So nobody will get a loaf of bread with like a nut or a washer in it. Okay, that's great. So for his demonstration, what's going to happen is there's going to be a metal detector, and then this cool blast of air is just going to like blow the loaf off the conveyor belt. And you can imagine a group of kids, we've got to see this. So he sticks this hunk of metal in a loaf of bread, which is already kind of weird, just like wasting a whole loaf of bread. I was like, wow. So it goes by the metal detector, and it goes past the blast thing, and then the hot air just like goes between, or the thing that's supposed to shoot it off the conveyor belt goes between the loaves, and the thing just goes sailing off with this big hunk of metal in it. So it was just kind of a funny image for industrial bread production. But you could call up the Snyder's factory, which is just a couple miles away, is where they make any industrial bread. And one of the things you'll learn in an industrial bread factory is that from start to finish, those loaves are done in 90 minutes. It's an incredible accomplishment. It requires all kinds of chemistry to make that happen. Because the loaf of bread you buy at Common Crumb, it's labor intensive. It takes hours. And that's why it costs $7, right? So back to our reading. What was another social status connection between white flour? If white flour is so much less tasty and so much less nutritious, why are we eating so much of it? Can anybody give the cultural angle?
Well, I remember reading about how milled flour was more expensive, so wealthier people had it, and then once everybody could have it, everybody wanted it.
Yeah, right. It's a really good instance. Okay, let's get this in our notes. It's a really good example of food culture. Because the original value was high status for high labor delicacy, right? I mean, there's a reason white flour is used in pastries. It tastes, it's more delicate, right? And then that gets into the culture, and then white flour continues to be associated with status, even though the industrial product is not nutritious and doesn't taste good and isn't good for you. So it's a really good example of food culture affecting people's choices in an ideological way. Okay, anything else? Any other details? Oh, so then we fortified the bread, but then you get this study that says, look, people could be getting equivalent nutrients, but they're not getting a lot of other things that go along with the whole bread experience. By the way, the loaf from Common Crumb from an artisan bakery has exactly 4 ingredients in it, and they're all... It is made from scratch in the full sense of the word. It's going to be freshly milled flour. It's going to be yeast. It's a natural organism that's cultivated. A little bit of salt and water. Right? The bread that you visit at Snyder's, it's got a lot of chemicals to make that happen in 90 minutes. Okay. So that was kind of Whole Foods to refine. Gets back to this, gets back to our discussion here, because it allowed us to see that carbs are not all equivalent, right? The carbs in this muffin come from whole wheat bread, and complex sugars like maple syrup or molasses. Those are wild sugars, so they have a lot of variations of sugar molecules in them. Nobody's sure exactly what the health effect is, but some people think that you metabolize natural sugars differently from refined sugars. This has highly processed white flour plus added granular sugar. Okay. Other comments on whole food to refine? Did we get that one down? So complex to simple, can we just talk about that together? This is the idea that along with simplifying the product by refining it, and degrading it, you grow it in degraded soil. And as I said, we're going to study soil a little bit in the course. There's also, I'm going to add this, I forgot to get this into the other class. There's also the loss of diversity. And I just had this, I got this out of a book a long time ago, and I just wanted to show it to you. This is the number of commodities produced for sale in at least 1% of Iowa farms from 1920 to 2007. So one thing that happened, he talks about the monoculture of industrial food, but what happened is we just gave up a huge variety of food. You see the point of this chart? Diversity of foods is one of the predictors of a healthy diet. So we put in your notes this way. Industrial food moves us to monocultures and reduces the variety of food products in the food system.
Well, this could also have to do with ease of production and, I mean, food being able to be imported from other states.
Yeah. It could be that once you have global markets now, Iowans don't need to grow
everything.
Yeah, there could be efficiency reasons why we would want to reduce local production diversity. Just depend. You have to look at the whole picture. Good. Okay, then the quality to quantity. Here you've got research, which some of this research is linked from the wiki page, front page, on reduction in food nutrients. There's a couple of angles here. He mentions most of them, I think. Let's see if we can get these in your notes. Nutrition in food has been documented to have declined for a variety of reasons. One reason is that the quality of soil has declined. Another reason is that the varieties that we choose now grow faster, and there's evidence that it takes time to absorb minerals and nutrients from soil. So putting your notes this way, faster grow times lead to lower nutrition. So we have depleted soil, faster grow times. The third one is, I don't know if he mentions this one, variety selection. So if we choose varieties that are bigger because consumers like them and they're bigger, blemish-free, they travel better, right? An effect of that is that you have to eat a larger volume of that fresh food to get the nutrients. You see the point? So if a zucchini is going to be 20% bigger because the variety that people like is the one where the zucchinis look really big, I mean, I go for the big blemish-free food. Do you guys, when you're buying fresh food? I mean, it's kind of a natural thing. The point for your notes is that the bigger variety is less nutrient-dense, right? Because it's going to have depleted nutrients partly because of the sheer volume, partly because of the soil. But so if you're going to try and get the nutrients that you want from that food product, you're going to have to eat a larger volume of food. Or, failing that, you're going to get lower nutrients. Does that make sense? And I wouldn't blame food industry necessarily. This is what consumers like. Consumers like blemish-free big examples. And so you could be looking at an organic version of something. It's going to be small. It's going to have a few blemishes. It's going to cost more. The psychology is all wrong, right? It's like, wow, why would I want to buy that? I'm not going to get as much. But the nutrition is invisible to some extent. And one of the things that there's a lot of angles like this. I don't want to put too much emphasis on them because some of them are speculative. But there is some evidence that organic plants have a different micronutrient profile because they've had to respond to pests. And so just like us, they have immune responses. And one of the chemical differences that some researchers speculate is that the phytonutrients, this is a relatively new category of micronutrients, you could read about it if you want. Fresh, organic fruits and vegetables have phytonutrients. Some people connect them with anti-inflammatory responses. And this researcher he cites, Bruce Ames, would be an example of a serious medical researcher who's claiming, along with many others, that fresh organic foods grown properly can help provide protection against cancer because they contain some of the kind of inflammatory response chemicals that we need also. So the theory goes along with the idea that inflammation is a precursor to cancer in us. Feel free to look into that. I don't want to spend too much time on it because some of these things are they're speculative, but there is serious science behind them. So I don't want to oversell them. Okay, any other details from that? We get the idea there? So again, that's part of the indictment against not only industrial processed food, but industrially grown fresh food. Okay. Then leaves to seeds. Let's kind of work this in. Take a minute and look at this. There's a lot of detail to this part of his account. And this starts around, it's over by 129. Would you just go page through like 126 to 129? We'll do this together. Or 125. This section's kind of focused on the omega-3, omega-6 issue, right? So let's kind of remind each other about that. We're going to study that in more scientific way later in the course. So what is let somebody try to get us started on a summary of what his point is. Here. Why did we move from foods that were heavy in omega-3 oils to foods that were heavy in omega-6?
So for plants that have a bunch of omega-3 oils in them, they spoil really quickly, so they want to remove all of this.
Yeah, so again, similar to the flour story, right? You want to trade out unstable oils for stable oils, right? And so you get this startling claim. I forgot about this. The ratio of omega 6 to omega 3 oils went from 3-1 to 10-1 in our diet. It's a huge change. What else? There's an interesting angle he makes at 129 here let's get more of the basic story out. So what's the leaves to seeds part of this? I mean, there are oils in leafy vegetables, right? So they tend to be more omega-3 oils. So the point for your notes is that as our diet shifted from leaf-based, plant-based diets to seed-based diets, where we were eating predominantly more seed oils, we lost phytonutrients, and we took on more omega-6, which is associated with heart disease. Omega-3 is also associated with mental health. Some very interesting connections here. Let's make sure you make a connection in your notes to the lipid hypothesis, right? Because this fits into Pollan's argument. It's not unique to him. He's reporting it. That the lipid hypothesis is faulty because it doesn't distinguish between types of fats. Good. And to some extent, we didn't know about it. You know, we didn't know about omega-3 versus omega-6 back with when Ansel Keys was giving his healthy heart cookbook back in the 70s. Or, no, earlier, 50s. Okay. There was a really interesting point about how different oils leave you feeling less satisfied. And when we get into the equation between nutrition and satisfaction, it is interesting. I don't know if any of you can relate to this, but I have a kind of pet speculative theory that one reason people have trouble with organic plant-based diets is that you do have less of a reservoir. You're not carrying around as much stored nutrition as you would with a diet that's heavier in fats and meats. So I don't want to make a big deal out of it. I just want to see if this resonates with any of you. So part of the idea was that we have a psychology that makes us afraid that we're going to be hungry. Have any of you experienced fear of hunger? I mean, we're in such abundance. It's kind of, yeah. You're like, oh, no, what if I don't get food soon? You know, and it's a little panicky feeling. You know, you're surrounded by food. Most of you have plenty of resources to buy food. So it's a kind of a weird feeling. And when I changed my diet, I did feel a little food insecure. So I can kind of relate to that. It was like, wow, so I'm going to be getting my nutrition more from the food that I eat than from overeating and drawing on stored calories, basically. That's the argument. So it could be one thing that could affect your courage to try an elimination diet if the thing you're eliminating is a source of food, psychological food security to you. And I think the hamburger is kind of like one of the quintessential examples of this. The hamburger delivers this incredible kind of satisfaction that you know is going to stay with you. There's a lot of calories. It's calorie dense. It's not nutrient dense. But it's got some of the nutrients, like we talked about the feeling of protein, right? It's got some of the nutrients that make us feel solid. So this Carl's Jr., 31 grams of protein, it's going to give you kind of that solid feeling you have when you take, like, if any of you have taken protein mixes after a workout, right? Anyway, I don't want to make too much of it, but it's kind of a neat detail. Let's see. Right. So national food cultures, I meant to pass this around earlier, but it kind of fits in better here. National food cultures are often defined by, there wasn't much content in this section, so I thought I'd fill this in with it. They're often defined by major cookbooks, and I wanted to challenge some of you who have ethnic food histories or, you know, ethnicities that are connected, that connect you to food cultures, ethnic food cultures. I'd like you to maybe look into your ethnic food culture if you're curious about it and see when was it consolidated as a national cuisine. And so we have examples, and I'll give you the Italian and the U.S. example. In Italy, most food historians would say that Pellegrino Artusi produced the Italian Betty Crocker cookbook, the defining cookbook of Italian cuisine. And it was an interesting moment. It was during Italian unification. It was the end of the 19th century, and Italy wasn't really a unified country. Artusi actually is credited with creating Italian cuisine, not by creating it, but by bringing a diversity of regional cuisines under one book that kind of, in people's minds, defined Italian cooking. Italians started to see themselves as sharing a common food culture, which is pretty cool. So food cultures they're not natural, they're made. They're artifacts that are made partly by people doing this, creating a book or a set of traditions, practices that define the culture. So I'll pass this around. It's in great condition. The recipes are kind of historic. They're not necessarily things that you could look at a couple, see if they would appeal to you. So the other example is The Joy of Cooking, which is kind of ours in a way. We have a couple. The national cookbooks. We have a Betty Crocker. We have Julia Child gets in, but not notice Julia Child gets in to our food culture as the woman who brought French cooking to the U.S. and made it practical for ordinary Americans to cook like French people. Right? That was kind of her project is not a national cookbook project. It's more of a food immigration project. Right? Like bringing food culture from one culture to another. But ours is often defined by The Joy of Cooking, and there's just an oddity here that I thought you guys might like. Oh, wait a minute, I'm sorry. I wanted to read from that and show you the... So this is the facsimile page of the 1931 Joy of Cooking. And the cover shows St. Martha of Bethany, the patron saint of cooking, slaying a dragon, the dragon of kitchen drudgery. The jacket blurb stresses the connection between the saint and the modern woman, faced with tasks almost as diversified as St. Martha's, and cooking is not the least of the problems she must meet with intelligence and understanding. So you have, anybody want to do the analysis here? What's being communicated between the lines in this image about American cooking? Anybody do this? It's kind of weird because it's mixed with a religious image, a saint.
It's almost like cooking is a chore, so this is going to show you how you can actually take pleasure in cooking.
Cooking sucks. Good, but we're here to make it better. And notice better here means it's going to be more interesting, it's going to be less work. This is 20 years before the 1950s burst of kitchen appliances, making, again, the same cultural ideology that our modern national cuisine is defined partly by convenience, right? You see where we can draw this out? It's partly defined by convenience and freeing yourself from traditional practices. Because drudgery is a stand-in for laborious cooking. And notice it fits into our culture because it's not too long. It's not only a few decades before women are going to be saying, yeah, and I'd like to get a job too. How about that? You know, I'd like to have a career. So the American push toward convenience coincides with other social movements like that, right? Okay. Any other comments about that? I just thought it was a weird, kind of a weird religious image too, of putting St. Bethany, St. Martha, is it? Okay. So, and national food culture. So back to pollen, though. What's his point? We stopped relying. This is a point for your notes. We stopped relying on. We stopped relying on the wisdom of traditional food cultures, and we let the scientists tell us how to eat. And the scientists knew stuff. They knew about vitamins. I mean, why wouldn't you listen to the scientists? You should listen to good science. But Pollan's point is you shouldn't give up your food culture. And what we've done is we've gone back, and again, this is a challenge to some of you to study your own ethnic food cultures, whether they're German, Polish, or, you know, Central American, or Brazilian, or whatever they are, and find the food wisdom in your ethnic food cultures. Because they're there. It's there. Not all food cultures have healthy, traditional foods, but taken as a whole, they're usually pretty healthy diets. And they can vary, right? They can be meaty or not meaty. But they usually combine foods to get better proteins, more complete proteins. And so he's saying that we made a mistake by giving up some of the wisdom in traditional food. Okay, let's take a 2-minute break. Stretch your legs. Catch up on your messages. Use the restroom if you need to. And we'll come back and look at this video on vertical farming and then talk a little bit about Nestle and the article you didn't get quizzed on. 2 or 3 minutes, okay? On the quiz. So let's just do a couple of things for our notes just to get the story here. So the main structure you need is how she develops the story from eat more to, wow, what's this? I don't like that at all. To eat less. And if you're doing it as a timeline, you definitely want to make the pivot point. She actually calls it the pivot point. 1977, because of the McGovern Committee, right? Everybody remembers that? And so what you've got, let's just get a few of the data points into your notes here, and so we can kind of see how this fits with some other things we read. So one thing she does is she tells about the early USDA surveys of food capacity and food consumption. And so this is late 19th century, early 20th century. This is before people even understood vitamins. We still had dietary diseases. Add this into your notes here.
So this is 1900. Let's use that as our marker. Some of this happens before, some of it happens after. You've still got dietary diseases like beriberi, pellagra, and scurvy, which we'll read about more later. So you've got food undernutrition, so the message is eat more. You also get the eat more message from war policy, where we are encouraging people to food for freedom. We encourage people to eat a lot of calories, be strong for the war effort. Then you also have the war on poverty coming in the 60s, where we discover that a third of the country is in poverty and not receiving adequate nutrition. So the message was, if you're not meeting your RDAs, just eat more food and then you'll hit them. So again, the eat more message was reinforced that way. And then this transition period, I really want to give it from the, it's really the late 1980s, she starts to describe, is it starts with the McGovern Committee, and Ansel Keys, studies of fat and heart disease, so the lipid hypothesis comes in here, right? But in the politics of the McGovern Committee, as you know from other readings, you couldn't say eat less. You had to say, the details on page 40 if you have the article handy, you had to say, you couldn't say reduce meat consumption. You had to say choose meats that will reduce your fat intake. Does everybody see what's problematic about that? If you tell people, if you can't tell people to eat less, and you're always telling them, choose more of these things, people who have enough money will keep eating what they're eating, and then they'll eat those things too. And that's what we did. We took the choose meats which reduce saturated fat intake, we took that to mean, oh yeah, and we'll eat some of those too. So our calorie, our average daily calorie level kept rising really through the 20th century. But our politics didn't allow us to address overall calorie intake because that would be an eat less message. So finally, around the late 80s, we get this, she reports it this way, we get this consensus because a number of very authoritative reports come out against high-fat meat. That's when we started to move away from highly marbled meats, and the cattle industry responded by growing leaner cattle. And they could make more money on leaner cattle because they were feeding it corn, right? So when I was a kid, meats were marbled with fat, and that's the yummiest meat, right? Mm-hmm. But we took this seriously. We started notice in the mark it in your notes. This is the she refers to this in the intro as nutrition transition, a phenomenon in which cultures move from malnourishment to. One form of malnourishment of being underfed to another form of malnourishment of being overfed and undernourished. And that transition occurred between the 70s and the late 80s. Okay? The interesting ending to this narrative is that she documents the point at which the industry stopped resisting. Put this in your notes. After the late 80s, the food industry still exerted pressure. The federal government would never say, eat less red meat. That happened exactly once, right? Instead, we give the eat more of these other things. But finally, in the late 80s, we did start to say, eat less. So put it in your notes. We finally started to say, maintain ideal weight, reduce overall intake, because the obesity epidemic had finally been so well documented. And so what happens? Does the industry keep resisting the eat less message? No. This is the important point for your notes that Nestle makes. The industry stops resisting the eat less message. Why? You guys know the answer to this.
Would that just be to like kill keep sales or even increase sales?
How does it? I mean, how could an eat less message work for the food industry to increase sales? You're on the right track. Good. We can connect a couple dots. That's good.
Is it because of all the money that was going into the medical aspect of it? Or they're getting out of the medical aspect?
I'm not sure what you mean by the medical aspect.
How they're talking to Pollen about how medical costs are really high and scientists are getting paid more to research more of how we can address these medical issues.
You're absolutely right that part of the transition, and I just tagged it really quick. With Ansel Keys, part of the transition phase here is just an overwhelming evidence that there's a connection between coronary heart disease, for example, and our diet. So yeah, that is part of this puzzle. But why specifically did it make sense for industry to stop resisting the eat less message?
Because they were making foods with fewer calories and selling those.
A little broader. You're on the right track. Okay, I'll just do it. Right. Nutritionism, because the industry had gained enough control of the food product to be able to manipulate macro and micronutrients. And so nutritionism, this dovetails with the story Pollen told about nutritionism. Nutritionism comes about for the food industry when it realizes that it can keep marketing food based on the latest nutritional fads. So the industry stops fearing the eat less message, because they know they can get people to eat more food if they can manipulate the nutrients so that it's consistent with whatever the government's saying. So remember that work on nutritionism comes in.
Didn't you mention that about the Coca-Cola? They were adding omega-3s into it or something?
Right. I mean, so how many of you have seen food products that advertise omega-3 oils? Yeah, I don't know how credible that is. They spoil, so I don't know what you have to add to get the omega-3 fats not to spoil. Maybe there's another way to stabilize them. I don't know. I would like to know more about that. But the short answer for your notes is that the eat less message became politically and commercially palatable because, no pun intended, because industry had to face the overwhelming evidence, but also had resources for manipulating food products so that they could keep increasing sales. And the evidence is there. I mean, between the 80s, late 80s, and the early 2000s, sales of industrial food products go up, and the obesity, diabetes, and coronary heart disease epidemic keeps going. So we didn't solve the problem, even though we transitioned from an eat more to an eat less message. And that last page of the article really gives you a great summary. So if there's anything you want to go back to in that article, that would be the place to go. Okay, should we stop there? Okay, see you guys Thursday.